All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 44 of the SLS Cast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, we are now in line with Dirty Harry Callahan. Yes, why? Because he was the man who popularized the 44 Magnum handgun. Do you feel lucky? Well, do ya? Yeah. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. This is episode 44. I am your host, Matt.
And this is the lesser qualified, yet stunningly handsome other co-host, Tim.
Okay. Just remember you said that, not me.
I know you were thinking it, and I know everyone else was thinking it as well. Well, apparently the other day I overheard a conversation of two people discussing those who are knowledgeable of movies, or whether or not they are able to be the ones to critique movies or not, and apparently people that watch movies or have a degree in television and film, or even have experience working on movies and TV, or writing scripts or anything like that, they don't know nothing. Know nothing whatsoever.
Yes, that's clearly it. Yes, clearly it. So how you been doing, sir?
I've been doing well. I'm just kind of wondering. I want you to regale us with tales from the Dallas Comic-Con. I'm excited to hear if you were able to talk to anybody, or better yet, if you actually got to twerk Katie Sackhoff's left breast.
Okay, so I'm going to leave you in suspense on Katie Sackhoff. I will let you know that there was a picture. Also that people in the line who saw what was happening also got a kick out of it. But that's all I'm saying for now. Dallas Comic Con was pretty darn cool, I gotta say. I got to see a whole bunch of interesting cosplay, and I got to meet and shake hands with a handful of famous and dubiously famous people. As I had said before, I was a VIP, and so they give you these they give you line jumps for the VIP. And I went with my buddy Rob, and so we took off Friday morning and drove up there. We got to meet Anthony Daniels several times because he would go through the VIP lines on Saturday and Sunday while we were all waiting to get in, and he would just kind of coast along through there just for fun. So we got to see all that kind of fun stuff, got to do some really neat Q&As, and there's a world. It's a world, dude. I thought that my nerd was strong, but it is not. My nerd is very weak. I suppose that's kind of socially good, but whatever. I would say probably about 20% of the people there, over less than 20%, were actually in cosplay. And I'm including everybody. I'm including people who even half-assed it.
Were you in cosplay? Did you dress up as anybody?
Dressed up as me? No. No. There's really only two people that I could dress up like. I can do Walter from The Big Lebowski, and then I can do Peter Griffin, who I am actually coincidentally going to be for Halloween. See? Yeah, you can picture that in your head. All right, and then, of course, I would say of the cosplay. Now, remember, like I said, there's about less than 20% of everybody who went was in cosplay, and I would say there was at least, Saturday was the biggest day, and I would say there were at least 12,000 people, at least, probably more than that. It was huge. Took up three floors, whole floors, of the convention center in Irving. But of the cosplayers, I would have to say that, a goodly portion were very well done. Where I would say were, like, really cool. Maybe even some of these people were professional cosplayers. Then there were the women. And there were quite a few women that I were very glad cosplayed some very cool stuff.
Any of the Leias there?
Yes, as a matter of fact, there was a chick who showed up on Friday night and was in Anthony Daniels' Q&A, and she was dressed up like Padme from episode 2. And she was pretty attractive, and then she had even mentioned in the Q&A, because Anthony Daniels was like, wow, you know, you're all dressed up, whatever, blah, 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 you know, you look a great Padme. She's like, oh yeah, I've got a slave Leia too. And so everybody was like, woo, yay, whatever, right? And so that was pretty much the end of that. And then Saturday afternoon, this, oh dear God, amazing slave Leia walks by. And I'm like, holy crap, she is the girl from yesterday. Oh my God, she really does have a slave Leia outfit. And turns out that she should just be slave Leia all day long. And then there were girls, the very first truly interesting cosplayer that I noticed was this girl. She was not unpleasant. We shall say that the top half of her was buxom, okay, which, and for those of you who need the vocab lesson, that is plump yet attractive.
Buxom, okay. I've never heard anybody ever use that vocabulary word. I think the last time I've ever used it was in a sentence in the fifth grade. Buxom.
Well, that there was good. You go. B-U-X-O-M. Buxom. Plump, yet attractive. And then, and she was dressed up as some kind of demon chick, right? So, you know, she had like the bodice on and then the fishnets or whatever. But that's not what caught my attention, see? Because what caught my attention was the 79-inch ghetto ass that she had with wings attached at the hips, okay? And I'm walking the convention floor where they have all the vendor stuff, and the literal words out of my mouth were, "Oh my god, it's Comic-Con." That was literally what came out of my mouth because I could not believe what I was looking at. So there were girls like that, too. And them's the ones you kind of wish didn't do it. Then after that, I don't know, I saw some very creative people. I saw a guy dressed up as, I can't remember if it was Donatello or Raphael from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but he was done completely out of balloons. It was when you make animal shapes with balloons, right?
Right.
It was those. So he had them all wrapped around his body and everything. And it was pretty cool. I was impressed. And then there was a guy who had a pretty cool Assassin's Creed outfit, but then he's wearing jeans underneath. And I'm like, really, dude? I mean, you know, it's kind of half-assing it. And then, I don't know what it was, but there was some stuff going around on Twitter because for the weekend, I was following at Dallas Comic Con or whatever it was. So, you know, for updates and what have you. On the Facebook page, they had asked, what's everybody's favorite cosplay so far? And people just all over the place just kept saying, Disney villains, Disney villains. I never got to see the Disney villains that were there. But I swear to God, all over the place, Ariel. There was like 25 Ariels. I could not, in various forms. They had the full-on bride Ariel. They had just regular Ariel running around with feet. The mermaid version of Ariel. And I was like, okay, I don't know why.
They probably saw DCC and they thought Disney Comic-Con.
Well, see, that's just it, though. Because Disney was supposed to come out on Saturday to plug the 25th anniversary of The Little Mermaid, and they were actually giving away Blu-rays and DVDs and shirts and posters and all that stuff from, like, signed art and everything. They were doing all this stuff for, but then they, like, never showed up, and it was kind of a deal. So I kept seeing all weekend, though. It wasn't just Saturday. I kept seeing all these Ariels, and I was like, man, I wish I could find the Disney princesses. And then about 3:45 on Sunday, it was literally as we were walking out, I finally saw a different Disney princess. I saw Rapunzel from Tangled. And I was like, oh my god, there's another one. And that was it. Probably the scariest cosplay dude, though, was Aquaman. Okay? Now, anybody who knows me knows that I am portly, shall we say. Okay?
Buxom?
That's right. So you're getting buxom and portly today. Now, I am not like blubbery, falling over all over the place. Dear God, what's wrong with you? But I'm fat, okay? I mean, we're not... Anybody who knows me knows I am fat, so whatever. There was a guy bigger than me in a skin-tight Aquaman suit. And that's just some shit you don't need to see. I'm cool if people want to be fat. Just please follow hygiene and cover that shit up because nobody wants to see it. This guy, I stayed away from. I was scared. Very, very scary. So that's my cosplay experience there.
And I bet that guy always showed up like right around when you were wanting to eat lunch or eat something. He'd walk by.
Yeah, I didn't eat at that convention center. Let me tell you right now, there was no way I was eating at that convention center. And so the cosplay part was definitely interesting. But in terms of Q&As and stuff like that, I did get to do, I did the Battlestar Galactica Q&A. And that was because that was the one that Rob wanted to do. I wasn't particularly there for that. But it was nice. I got to actually... It was the first time I ever actually got to see Katie Sackhoff as, like, a normal person. And, man, is that chick full of double entendres. It was really funny, though. So, did the Michael Patrick Q&A, the Anthony Daniels Q&A. Ron Perlman Q&A, and then on Sunday, we did the John Barrowman Q&A. And that was the whole reason that I was there, was to meet John Barrowman. And I definitely got to do that. John Barrowman is an actor made famous by his appearance as Captain Jack Harkness on Doctor Who, which then got spun into his own TV series called Torchwood. This is a guy who is not even infamous, just straight up awesome for literally letting you do virtually anything in a photo with him, except you can't kiss him. Apparently that was a convention rule, but I suspect that was really his rule. They just kind of, the convention took the heat for it. But yeah, so there's like pictures of a group of people who got in on a picture and they were holding him up and had his legs spread eagle in front of the camera, and that was their pose. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you do. And if you ever go to social sites like, you know, Reddit or whatever, people always are making front page for pictures with him from conventions. And so I thought I would do my part by just going in there, shaking his hand, posing, smiling for the camera, and then go, you know, look, he takes normal pictures too, right? And so that was my plan. I had a plan, right? I go in there, and then he takes one look at me when I go to take, but I was like the seventh person in line or something. No, fourth person? I don't know. It was like right there at the beginning. So I walk right up to him, and I'm like, hey, man, it's really great to meet you. He's like, awesome. Let's cuddle. So I just did what he told me to do. So I cuddled, and in my picture I cuddled, and that was. And then when the picture was taken, he just kind of squeezed a little bit and said, "You're a great cuddler." And I was like, "Well, thank you." And
what did he squeeze?
My shoulders.
Yeah.
It was a very clean cuddle. It wasn't a gropey cuddle. He'll do that though. I mean, he'll grab your butt. He'll grab your crotch. You can grab his crotch. You know, whatever. One of the girls who was a volunteer showed us her picture, and he's just full on got her boobs.
Wow.
He's awesome. He's really cool. And his Q&A, hands down, was the best. He was just, I mean, he walks right up there. The applause dies down. He's like, let's just get straight to the questions. You know, I feed off you guys. Let's do this. And so he was just, yeah, it was fantastic. So he was the best. I actually have a pretty cool story that I've got the audio for. This is Robert Patrick talking about his experience on The Sopranos, and more specifically, kind of a funny story that he tells about James Gandolfini. And I think you guys are going to love it. If any faults of the audio are not due to the editing, they are due to having a voice recorder sitting on my leg surreptitiously in the second row. So here you go. Take a listen.
Alright, so here's the story, Sopranos. David Chase calls me up and he says, literally calls me and he's at my house and says, I want you to do my show. And I had never seen The Sopranos. It was only on one season. I hadn't seen it. So I'm listening and I go, okay. I think I'd seen like one. I wasn't as familiar with it, maybe. I kind of had heard about it, but I wasn't that familiar with it. So I kind of acted like I knew a little bit more than I did. And, I don't know if I went that far, but I kind of went, oh, yeah, okay, sure, cool. Can I read the script, you know? I think, yeah. And he said, this is a role that you're probably never going to get. People wouldn't cast you this way. And when I read the script, I realized why. Because he was going to have James Gandolfini bitch slap me around. I was going to cry like a little three-year-old. And I realized,
you're already going in the direction I was going to take.
Yeah, so all right. So now I've got to get past my ego of being a man and wanting to fight back and all that kind of stuff. And I talked to my acting coach, Stephen Bridgewater, and we both do it. And I had this offer for this other movie to do for a lot of money, and then I had this experience on The Sopranos, which was not. And I chose to do art over economics and went with it. And I think I had a film at the Venice Film Festival called Texas Funeral. Work in Texas.
Texas
Funeral I did with Martin Sheen. And it was at the Venice Film Festival. I flew in and I did the script read through of Sopranos. And I went outside the Silver Cup Studios and I was smoking a cigarette with Gandolfini out there. And I really didn't know him that well. And I said, the next day I was doing a scene where he was supposed to come in and throw me around like a rag doll. I just looked at him and I said, I hope tomorrow you bring your A game. You guys that know Jimmy Gandolfini, God bless him, He just looked at me and he went, "Oh yeah." I'll make sure I bring my email. So the next day we go in there, and it's the scene where, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's the scene where he comes into my sporting goods store, and I owe him money from this poker game I play. And he grabs me, starts slapping me around, punching me, and I start crying. And the first thing he says that morning, he comes in and he reeked, man. He must have been out drinking all night. He was hungover and everything. He comes in, he says, he looks at me, he goes, "How's your balls?" What? "How's your balls?" "I think they're okay." Oh boy. So it went from there, man. And he had no problem picking me up and throwing me around. He was pretty goddamn intense. God rest his soul. He's a great actor.
I really like that story. I thought it was pretty cool. He does talk about all sorts of other stuff. I've got one more thing that I want to talk about, but that's for the news with Hellboy 3 news from Ron Perlman, and we'll definitely get to that for the news. But all in all, had a fantastic time. I ended up, the list of people that I ended up getting to meet was Anthony Daniels, Robert Patrick, Tom Felton, Ron Perlman, John Barrowman, Katie Sackhoff, Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex Luthor in Smallville, and John Heder, Napoleon Dynamite. And he really kind of sounds like Napoleon Dynamite, like normally.
It's kind of a little random one at the end.
It was great stuff. How was your last week?
My last week was good. Let's see. Yeah, I didn't get to magically air grope Katie Sackhoff or anything.
Oh, yeah, the Katie Sackhoff. I guess I should get to that now, shouldn't I? All right, so the plan was to stand on Katie Sackhoff's left side and then literally just point right at that boob, or as she says, "It's just a tit," and just point with a big, huge-ass smile on my face so that I could then post anywhere to anybody, you know, "Hey, guys, this is the one that I saw." And so I get up to Katie Sackhoff, and the way she was standing to do it, she was already on the left, and I couldn't get on the left-hand side. So instead, I didn't hover hand or nothing. I just put my arm on around her shoulders, and she put her arm around my waist, and I just pointed right at that rack with the biggest smile on my face, and everybody in line just started laughing. The photographer chuckled, and she's just smiling, because I don't think she was seeing it out of her, she might have seen it out of her peripheral vision, but she was really cool about it, and shook my hand, and I said thanks, and she said, "Not a problem," and off I went. There you go, folks.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's the big reveal.
Dun, dun, dun.
And at that point, let's go ahead and do it, folks. It is time
for news.
Oh, yeah, we have a show. I was getting caught up in reliving your past weekend with you.
It's good times. I know. This is awesome. I know. And my first piece of news is from Dallas Comic Con. Yes, that's right. Okay. This was probably the biggest thing that I found out movie-wise. I went to all these Q&As and stuff. So, I mean, I got to hear all sorts of neat stories and different stuff about TV and movies or whatever. I actually got to see some pretty cool movie trailers that hadn't come out yet, none of which were really important. Except the Jack Ryan movie, but now that's out, so everybody's seen that. But for the Ron Perlman Q&A, the moderator literally came right out of the box and said, "Okay, I'm going to save everybody the trouble. Everybody that, once they found out I was doing the moderation, wanted me to ask you, what's the deal with Hellboy 3? Okay? And unfortunately, because of the way that Ron Perlman was talking into the microphone, you can completely understand crystal clear everything that the moderator says, but you can't quite understand a whole hell of a lot of what he says. So, I've got it here quoted for you, and I'm going to read it for you. This was his response. His first quip was, "If the government ever reopens, write your congressman." Seriously, though, he goes on to say, quote, "I've gone on record as saying, at this point, single-handedly trying to keep the conversation going about Hellboy 3. By the way, When Hellboy 2 ended, we all vowed never to go back because we had such a hard shoot. It was physically demanding. It aged me. He goes on to say, quote, once the pain subsides and you start thinking about things in positive terms, which is generally what happens when you come through something like that, we just owed the fans a resolve. Is Hellboy going to be a victim of nurture or nature? His nature is to destroy the world, but he's nurtured to execute good. But I could really use a hand, so all you people who tweet, you know. He then concluded by saying, quote, I always said if I did another Hellboy, it would kill me, but what a way to go, end quote. I think at this point, he's pretty much saying that he would like to, probably not going to happen unless something like big fan-wise comes about. My next piece of news comes to us about Tom Clancy. He passed away last week, and that's rather sad. But I did want to note that it was actually for those of you who haven't heard of Tom Clancy, you guys need to figure out what rock you're under and come out of it. This is the guy who wrote the complex adrenaline-fueled military novels, spawned a new style of thrillers and video games. Passed away in Baltimore. He was 66 years old. He grew up in Baltimore. And he died at Johns Hopkins Hospital after a brief illness. Unfortunately, at the time that the article was published, no one knew the precise cause of death. But it was actually his debut book, The Hunt for the Red October, which has been frequently cited as one of the greatest genre novels ever written. All right. With the book's publication in 1984, Mr. Clancy introduced a new kind of potboiler, an espionage thriller dense with technical details about weaponry, submarines, and intelligence agencies. He almost never got it written. He was an insurance salesman. He was writing on the side, and he went to some friends to actually get the book published. And because he was unknown, and the people that he went through didn't actually know what to do with this kind of a book. Deborah Grosvenor, who was an editor for the Naval Institute Press, which is where he initially submitted the book, finally got some people to back it, and they paid him $5,000 for the book, and they published it in 1984. The Hunt for Red October became a runaway bestseller when then-President Ronald Reagan, who had been handed a copy, called it, quote, my kind of yarn, end quote, and said that he couldn't put it down. And this is probably what made Tom Clancy's career right here. The article says, but it's details about Soviet submarines, weaponry, satellites, and fighter planes raised suspicions. Even high-ranking members of the military took notice of the book's apparent inside knowledge. In a 1986 interview, Mr. Clancy said, quote, when I met Navy Secretary John Leeman last year, the first thing he asked me about the book was, quote, who the hell cleared it, end quote. Turns out, no one did, Mr. Clancy insisted. All of his knowledge came from technical manuals, interviews with submarine experts, and books on military matters, he said. While he spent time on military bases, visited the Pentagon, and dined with military leaders, he said he did not want to know any classified information. And I think this is probably the perfect way to sum up Mr. Clancy. Quote, I hang my hat on getting as many things right as I can. I've made stuff up that's turned out to be real. That's the spooky part. End quote. This is a guy who helped develop video games that were so revolutionary that the Army actually used them for training. So proof positive, if you just read some books, you can learn anything. You too can become a multimillionaire novelist and video game guy and movie magnate just by reading. Last but not least, this comes to us from UnleashTheFanboy.com. The previous article, sorry, I guess I should probably quote that and be a nice person instead of being an asshole, came to us from TheNewYorkTimes.com, courtesy of Julie Bosman, so hat tip to her. Finally for me, UnleashTheFanboy.com, thanks to Steve L. Marvel shuts down Punisher fan film. That's right. Sure, Marvel has every right to govern its wide world of superheroes with an iron fist, but this seems like a bit much. In a bizarre move, the studio has officially requested that production on the Punisher fan film, The Dead Can't Be Distracted, must cease, and that all marketing materials associated with the flick be removed from circulation. Based on Greg Rucka's semi-reimagined version of the classic Frank Castle, this little fan piece was meant to be everything that the original three Punisher flicks weren't. A true adaptation of the source material. So, why did the big boys shut it down? Well, Marvel Studios has claimed that the movie would confuse the public, which is pretty damn flattering for the fan flicks creator Mike Petchy. The House of Ideas considers this little pet project a rival for their silver screen empire. Awesome! But it's also a strange warning to the rest of fandom who so passionately produce fan films. This is what Marvel actually wrote. Quote, "While we appreciate your affection for the character, we must demand that you immediately stop your unauthorized use, advertising, sale, and/or distribution of any production of The Punisher or any other Marvel character-based films therefore, and any other use of the images, likenesses, artwork, or other intellectual property owned by Marvel. Quote, your actions confuse consumers into believing that they are viewing an authentic Marvel production or one sponsored or licensed by Marvel when they are not. Quote, Marvel reserves the right to take whatever remedies are available to it at law and in equity and shall do whatever best protects its interests. End quote.
I don't see how Marvel could not benefit from this fan movie. I mean, especially if they even decided, like, oh, hey, we'll take a look at it, and if we like it, or if people like it, then we will help distribute it and be a part of it in some way.
Well, what makes it even more frustrating, I would think, is this. The writer of the original tale, which inspired this flick, Greg Rucka, along with the comics artist Marco Cicchetto, both support this fan film. The dudes who should have the most to bitch about actually endorse Petchy and his flick. Marco said as much in this pithy statement. Quote, holy shit, I'm very impressed. I don't know how you did it, but you hit the full atmosphere of my pages. End quote. Now, the author thinks that there is method to the madness here. He thinks that Marvel might be bringing the Marvel Knights to the big screen. Now, if you're not familiar with the Marvel Knights, this is what he has to say. If you're not familiar with this misfit group of loosely affiliated heroes, they're mostly comprised of New York City's street-level vigilantes. Daredevil, Moon Knight, Iron Fist, and... da-da-da-da! Punisher. With Robert Downey Jr.'s final two Marvel movies on the horizon, and both Captain America's and Thor's respective individual trilogies nearly completed, a switch in scope to the Marvel Knights would be a welcome respite from the comic-level threats of the Avengers, considering viewer fatigue and everything. I gotta say, this is pretty shocking. I completely agree with you on this, Tim. I'd say I can't see how this is a bad thing. I think, strictly speaking, if they are actually selling it or trying to make money from it, then maybe I could see where Marvel might have a problem with it. Because the thing is that if something like this takes off and kind of like becomes its own franchise, if Marvel didn't stop it, then... if they tried to stop it, there would be a legal ramification of saying, look, you guys let us go this far. How can you stop us now? So I can kind of see that aspect. But if there is no money being made here, I completely agree with you. There's just no reason to stop them. All it does is make Marvel look better, sell more Marvel comics, and make people want a bigger presence for the Punisher anyway. And the thing is the teaser trailer looks really badass. So if you get a chance, check out the teaser trailer for the
Well, then
Dead
also
Can't
you don't see the people that are making that Mortal Kombat web series get into any trouble unless they have the rights to it, but I'm pretty sure that's a fan made.
No, that was actually sanctioned.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Yes. He was trying to get a movie made and they said, "No, I don't think that we can." So he said, "Well, let me have the source material. I'll show you what I can do." They said, okay. He then did that 3-minute reimagining thing, and they liked it so much they gave him permission to go ahead and do a web series. And then the web series has done really well, and now instead of doing a season 2, which they still might do, he's now trying to parlay that into an actual Mortal Kombat movie.
Alrighty, I have quite a bit of news this time around, so I'm gonna try to get through the quick ones as quickly as possible, but of course, Matt, please chime in at any time, because there's a lot of these that I'm curious to know what you think about them. First off, Gravity, which we will be going into more detail later on when we discuss the movies, currently holds the number one opening record with $55 million, and that is the number one opening record for the month of October. $55 million. And what's crazy is that Warner Brothers originally expected Gravity to come in between $35 and $40 million, or basically about on par with Pacific Rim, because Pacific Rim really didn't open as strongly in the US as they expected it to. Gravity became a huge hit. Huge. $55 million. And one of the reasons why I believe this worked out was not only the star power of Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, but also Warner Brothers promoted Gravity as a visual event. Kind of like with Avatar, once the buzz got around that you had to see this movie in IMAX, or you have to see this movie in 3D, people just flocked to go see it. And this movie, especially in IMAX 3D, or just in 3D on a big screen, has a high rewatchability factor to it. And so I guess, you know, that was enough to really pull it in. And also, the 3D screens, this is according to Collider.com, they say that the 3D screens accounted for over 85% of Gravity's 3,575 locations and brought in an impressive 80% of the film's overall estimate. 343 IMAX 3D dates accounted for another 20% of the film's opening, which means that a big majority of audiences paid a higher price for Gravity tickets this weekend. That's how records get broken. 3D and IMAX, especially with star power and good marketing, there you go. You got a big hit on your hands, and I think Gravity will be. There you go. $55 million. Next up is some news about Martin Scorsese and his upcoming film, Wolf of Wall Street. And Wolf of Wall Street is a story based on Jordan Belfort's memoir. It's about his corrupt business dealings on Wall Street, including his indulgence in sex, drugs, and his greediness with money, and just kind of overcompensating for, I guess, his character and insecurities with money and all the trouble he can get into. Well, the movie originally was supposed to open on November 15th. However, there have been rumors, and it's kind of come out in press releasings, that Paramount Pictures was wanting to move the movie to sometime in 2014. And if you're wondering if this sounds a little familiar with Martin Scorsese, it's because it is. This is kind of what happened with Shutter Island. Shutter Island was supposed to come out, I think, in the fall of 2000 and probably 2000, I think the fall of 2009 or something like that, and they pushed the movie till 2010. They're just worried that, well, will Wolf of Wall Street be pushed to January, or will it wait till next award season, which would be next August, September, October? But no. Turns out that Martin Scorsese and his longtime editor, Thelma Shoemaker, are hard at work trying to get this movie completely edited for a Christmas Day release. And that would mean that they are trying to get this movie edited by November 25th. And the reason why they're shooting for November 25th is because Scorsese is going to be judging the Marrakesh Film Festival, so he wants to get everything finished and completed before then. Yeah, so I mean, let's hope he does that, because given the star power, getting that it's Martin Scorsese, this is definitely, I'm going to go out and say it, I think this is going to be a great movie. At least the trailer looks great, so I think he'd be missing out on a Academy Award contender right here if he didn't take advantage of getting this movie edited in time. George Lucas's son Jet was interviewed by Flicks in the City, and it was during this interview that Jet talks about his father, George Lucas, and what he was doing with Star Wars before Disney got involved with the sequel trilogy.
Were you surprised when your dad kind of said, probably, you know, gone as far as I want to go now with Star Wars, and kind of passed the baton on?
You know, I wasn't, only because I knew that he was very torn on the matter. He wanted to... It was like a kid who had turned 18 and was ready to leave the house. And every parent, I don't know if you're a parent or not, but most every parent I've encountered anyways, has wanted to let their children go, but at the same time been like, leave, but I'm going to hold on to you until you actually leave. And so I think that's where he's at with that. I think he's ready to let it go and let it grow.
Did he talk about it in the family before he kind of made a final decision?
A little bit. I mean, we knew probably a year prior he had started writing and kind of researching and starting his whole little process. And about halfway through that process is when the idea of selling to Disney came up. And so that once those two collided, that's when he kind of sat down and said, okay, I'm going to do this. But he didn't really, he just kind of mentioned it offhandedly, like it wasn't a big deal. Like, we were eating dinner, or I was eating dinner, I wasn't even with him, he called me. It was just like a normal conversation. He's like, I asked how he was doing, and he's like, oh, I started writing again. And I was like, oh, like, you know, your little, like, whatever you're focusing on now. He's like, no, it's Star Wars and such, and then, like, moved on. And I was like, let's back up. Let's back up, like, a sentence. What are you writing now? And so that's when he kind of dropped that bomb, and it was nice, because he's happiest when he's writing and when he's doing something with his time. And so it was nice to hear.
Do you think he'll still keep a kind of watchful eye over what happens with it?
Yeah, I don't think he... I mean, as any parent watching their kid go to college would. He will definitely... He's constantly talking with JJ, and obviously JJ was handpicked, and he's there to guide whenever, and he will help where he can, but at the same time, like I said, he wants to let it go and become its new generation with a new generation of a director, like new everything.
Shedding some light on what George Lucas was doing before Disney was taking over, but it looks like he was actually working on the trilogy, which is kind of interesting. And people are worried about George Lucas actually taking over the current trilogy and kind of being the puppet master and J.J. Abrams being his puppet. However, I don't think that's the case. George Lucas made a statement. He came out and actually said that I am here for your help. If J.J. Abrams wants to talk to me and use some of the knowledge that George Lucas obviously has about the universe that he has created, he will be made available. And, you know, I think that is great, because I cannot see a Star Wars movie without there being some involvement from George Lucas. Say what you will about the prequel movies that George Lucas made, but I think the reason why that some of them worked, especially the reason why Episode 3 worked better than 1 and 2, was because George Lucas had a heavy hand involvement in the movies. And I think he does bring kind of that atmospheric Star Wars feeling to the movies that I don't think anybody can actually replicate. And it kind of sounds like J.J. Abrams and Disney is wanting to try to replicate and recreate that same feeling that we get while we watch, or that same feeling when we watched the original Star Wars trilogy.
Except
so
for
I think
the fact
it's important
that George Lucas
have.
Did not direct Empire Strikes Back or Return of the Jedi.
He didn't, but he produced it, and he helped write it. He had an outline for it.
Right, but the only thing, while everyone understands that without A New Hope, you know, it changed the face of cinema, blah, 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 blah. But on its own, as compared to 5 and 6... 4 is the worst of the original trilogy. And that's the only one that he did by himself.
Return of the Jedi is the worst of the trilogy.
Well, he's the one who thought up the Ewoks. They were supposed to be Wookiees, so...
Right.
Just something we'll never agree on, that's fine.
Yeah, I just think that it's, you know, it's important for him to not have a say-so, but just to be made available for whatever input. Another passing in the world of cinematic critiquing... Stanley Kaufman, who was the head movie reviewer for the New Republic, passed away. He died peacefully, but due to complications of pneumonia. He was 97 years old, which is kind of sad. When I read the article, I was doing some research about Stanley Kaufman. And after reading some of his excerpts and some of the reviews that he wrote, he had an interesting way of adding his own philosophy to his reviews. Whether it was about movies or life or just any specific thing in general, he just always had a broader way of reviewing movies. And it wasn't, if he was just disagreeing with the movie, it wasn't just a disagreement. He had a great explanation and examples and a very in-depth writer, and not just one that would just blow off a movie just because he absolutely hated it. So the Weinstein Company, they're in the news again. We talked about the Grandmaster a few weeks ago. Luckily, we watched the original Asian version of the movie, the original cut. But the Weinstein Company took the movie, they shaved off 20 minutes of it, getting rid of key moments and key character developments from that movie, and created a movie that didn't have the same emotional impact and just the same impact as general as its original cut. You know, they're doing it again. This time to Bong Joon-ho's Snowpiercer. Well, I was talking about a couple weeks ago that the Weinstein Company, who was going to distribute Snowpiercer in the U.S., they were going to do some recuts of the movie. Bong Joon-ho, the director, wasn't bothered by it. He was fine with cutting the movie a little bit and kind of crafting it more for an American audience's viewing pleasure. However, it is now reported by someone came out that is close with Bong Joon-ho, and they say that he is actually furious about the American cut of Snowpiercer. And according to this article, again by Matt Singer, he says that, quote, "Now it's early October, and we've looped back around to the beginning of the story. Variety reports that Bong, presenting Snowpiercer to an international audience at the Busan Film Festival, publicly told the English speakers in the crowd that this would be their only chance to see the film as he intended it to be watched." And Variety goes on to say also that Bong did not provide details of his differences with the Weinstein Company and understatedly said from the stage that the version for English language release would be a little bit different. But sources close to the director say that privately, he is furious. He has been quoted in other media as saying that up to 20 minutes are to be cut. End quote. So I believe Snowpiercer will be another movie that we'll have to try to find the Asian cut to see. Alright, so October 4th marked the 6th month of Roger Ebert's passing. And it was on that day when RogerEbert.com, his website, hosted a series of tributes. And that his wife, Chaz Ebert, introduced this collection of works, which were some of Roger Ebert's most beloved articles that he has written over the years. However, his most surprising, and probably one of his more controversial reviews, was the review he wrote for Rob Schneider's Deuce Bigalow European Gigolo. Yes, it was definitely one of the funniest, meanest reviews he has written for any movie. The background from the review, again, Matt Singer, Dissolve.com, Schneider and Los Angeles Times columnist Patrick Goldstein got into a bit of a feud over European Gigolo. Goldstein slammed it as an example of everything wrong with modern movies. Schneider retaliated by taking out full-page ads in the Hollywood Trade, slamming him right back and joking that it was unfair to mock him for not winning an Oscar since he, Goldstein, had never won a Pulitzer. And that was where Ebert hilariously inserted himself into the feud. And this is from Roger Ebert's review. He said that Schneider is correct, and Patrick Goldstein has not yet won a Pulitzer Prize. Therefore, Goldstein is not qualified to complain that Columbia financed Deuce Bigalow European Gigolo while passing on the opportunity to participate in Million Dollar Baby, Ray, The Avatar, Sideways, and Finding Neverland. As chance would have it, I have won the Pulitzer Prize, and so I am qualified. Speaking in my official capacity as a Pulitzer Prize winner, Mr. Schneider, your movie sucks. And then Singer again says, the review became the stuff of legend. Ebert even named a collection of pans after the last line, but Schneider didn't hold a grudge. When Ebert got sick and was in the hospital, he sent a bouquet of flowers and a note of support. So Chaz Ebert asked Schneider to write something for RogerEbert.com for this occasion, and he was gracious enough to do so. It's not exactly a very personal and candid letter, but this is what Rob Schneider wrote. He says, quote, as Roger once said, nobody starts out to make a bad movie, but it happens. I think every movie is difficult to make, but a sequel even more so. The movie I made just ended up being a series of jokes that really didn't hold up as a story or a movie, and I have to live with that. Sometimes a movie actor falls for the studio notion of, well, you can make it funny. And the next thing you know, you are standing in the middle of the street in Amsterdam with a bunch of male gigolos trying to figure out how the hell you got into this mess. Mr. Ebert's review was mean, but fair. Truthfully, it was not a good picture. End quote.
Well, it's nice for people to own up to their mistakes. The first Deuce Bigalow was good, and it's just kind of a shame that the second one did not fare as well. I think that's just what happens when you have a kind of a fun, original story that really doesn't have anywhere to go, but people want to make money anyways.
Right. And I will say that it is better than Poltergeist 3.
I'm pretty sure that Elysium was better than Poltergeist 3.
Okay, so I have two more news pieces here. This Oriental movie production company called Metropolis will be the most expensive film studio in history. This is from an article written by Vadim Rizov, written on September 23rd, 2013. And again, Dissolve.com. I'm just going to say it now. Last few articles are the Dissolve. Can't help it. And he says, quote, Wang Jianlin is China's richest man and the founder of the Dalian Wanda Group, which at this point may be the world's largest theater operator following the $2.6 billion purchase last May of the American AMC Theaters chain. Sunday, Jianlin announced he'll be putting $8.17 billion into the Oriental Movie Metropolis in Qingdao, a major city in the eastern state of Shandong, which he says marks the single biggest investment in a studio complex ever. Upon projected completion in 2017, the Metropolis will boast 20 sound stages, the world's first underwater studio, a shopping mall containing an indoor theme park modeled on Universal Studios, a permanent auto show, a celebrity wax museum, 7 resort hotels, and a yacht club with 300 berths. Wanda also recently purchased British yacht builder Sunseeker. As the New York Times' Keith Bradshaw observes, that last development is particularly notable since the Chinese government has banned nearly all use of yachts along the coastline, largely due to security concerns about ongoing thorny relations with Taiwan. Qingdao, Oriental Movie Metropolis, will be revolutionary. Improve the level of cultural industry in Qingdao. Wang promised when announcing the project Sunday, saying it will also greatly upgrade the level of tourism in Qingdao, and even transform Qingdao's positioning to turn into a city of global film and television cultural tourism. Once completed, Wanda says it's on track to have 30 foreign films shot there annually, plus 100 domestic movies and TV shows, though whether any formal agreements have been signed is unclear. Many Hollywood performers turned up for the announcement, including Kate Beckinsale, John Travolta, and Nicole Kidman. Forbes says it's estimated Wanda spent $2 million just getting Leonardo DiCaprio to attend, while The Independent pegs the total spent to lure Hollywood figures at $50 million. I'd go visit Metropolis 2. Would make a cool documentary, though.
I think so as well.
All right, so my last article. A lost Mary Pickford film is found in a New Hampshire barn. That's right, that is the Mary Pickford who teamed up with D.W. Griffin and Charlie Chaplin to create United Artists back in the early 1900s. She was one of, if not the, most famous silent actress of her era. And it turns out that a carpenter by the name of Peter Massey found and rescued the only known copy of the previously lost Mary Pickford silent short from certain destruction. Massey told the Associated Press that he found the film in 2006 in a barn in New Hampshire that he'd been hired to level and rebuild.
In the vault at Keene State College are several new additions to the rare film collection. Even more rare is what is believed to be the only copy of a classic Mary Pickford film thought lost decades ago. After intensive analysis, it turns out that the movie is the 1911 silent film classic Their First Misunderstanding. It was found in a stack of movie reels that turned up in this barn.
The homeowner wanted it taken down and a new barn built because there was no repairing what was there. He took out what he wanted from the barn and said anything else goes to the dumpster.
Massey held on to those old 35mm movies, and eventually the films found their way to Larry Bennequist in Keene State College.
Apparently it had been a boys' school, a boys' camp, and during the summer, they would set up this 35mm projector and show these ancient films to these boys who were swimming down on Granite Lake.
What the boys were watching was Their First Misunderstanding, starring Mary Pickford, which marked the first time her name was used to advertise a film. She plays a newly married housewife who meets a poet. Through a series of events, her husband begins to suspect she's in love with the poet. Pickford spends the rest of the film reassuring him that she only loves the man she married.
And the Mary Pickford Foundation does not have it listed as one of her writing credits. Plus, she was credited with writing other films like The Awakening and Made in December that were made prior to 1911. And once this film is restored, which actually I believe it is currently, it's already restored now, and it's supposed to be premiering at the Keene State College sometime this month. So if you're in or around Keene State College, you should look into this because it is supposed to be premiering sometime this month. I'm excited for the future to when more of these films will be uncovered. And who knows, maybe one day somebody will find a lost print of The Day the Clown Cried somewhere in their barn. And that's all I got.
And now, we move forward and on to Three Squares. Yes, Three Squared. All right, we're doing our favorite biopics. There's just a ton of biopics out there, so we each took our own different little take on it, so we might do this topic again in the future. All mine are black and white, and all of Tim's are like from the last 10 years or something like that. So this ought to be an interesting little play on this stuff here. First up for me, Yankee Doodle Dandy. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. Ah, that's right. You always think of this crazy-ass musical. Turns out that it is a musical, but it's a biographical musical film, and it's about a dude named George M. Cohen, who was known as the man who owns Broadway. And this was an Academy Award-winning performance for James Cagney. That's right, the "You'll Never Take Me Alive," Kappa, which, coincidentally, he never said, but everybody always credits him as saying, which is kind of funny. But this is just a fantastic movie. It's a 1942 movie, and this is basically coming out of the early days of World War II, where Cohen has just come out of retirement to star as President Roosevelt in the musical I'd Rather Be Right. He actually then is summoned to the White House, where he gets a Congressional Gold Medal, which he actually had won not that evening, but previously. And then from there, he talks to President Roosevelt and basically recounts the events of his life. And the movie ends with, because, you know, he's a struggling kid going up on vaudeville and with his family, and then thinks he's too big for his britches, and eventually gets kind of blacklisted, but fights his way back and overcomes and becomes super famous and everything. Almost like the Al Jolson story, not quite, but there were some similarities there. This movie is just it's just one of the classic films of the 40s. It is one of those movies where you feel a little patriotic. You kind of laugh a little bit at it because it is hokey. But at the same time, you really get a sense for that classic era of Hollywood. If you ever go to Walt Disney World and you head to Disney Hollywood Studios and you kind of walk down the streets that they have, and you'll see the street performers come up and stuff in the little parades, you kind of get that feeling of hokiness and stuff. But at the same time, that's kind of what this movie brings back, that charm of Hollywood in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and that studio system that gave us so many golden age of cinema classics. And yet at the same time, you have to kind of wonder if it ever really existed at all. And this movie really kind of encapsulates that. That's why I picked this movie. And of course, on its own, it's just a great movie. Next up for me is 1980s The Elephant Man. Now, yes, this is a 1980 film. However, it was done in black and white. It's the biopic based on Joseph Merrick. It's called John Merrick in the movie, starring John Hurt, Anthony Hopkins, Anne Bancroft, John Geigold, and Wendy Hiller. John Hurt is the one who plays John Merrick. He does just a fantastic job. This movie was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor. This is where you, if you've ever heard, "I am not an animal," then you know this film. And it pretty much just kind of picks up the last portion of Merrick's life, of where he is more or less rescued from the obscurity of the traveling freak show, to where he becomes kind of a medical and then high society show. And yet they don't mean to necessarily treat him as an object, because they do recognize that he's a person, but at the same time it's hard not to because of his condition and how unique it was, especially in someone of that stature at the time. And it's just a very touching film, very well acted, and very sad. This is not one of those happy-go-lucky movies. The whole thing is really very sad. And yet, what makes it so good is that through it all, there is a true spark of humanity in Merrick that just kind of makes you glad to be alive and be where you are. Last but certainly not least for me is 1941's Sergeant York. This is, if I remember correctly, the first Academy Award win for Gary Cooper. And this is, of course, the biopic based on the real-life Tennessee hillbilly Sergeant York. He is a guy from Backwoods, Tennessee. He's a drunk farmer who happens to be just a crack shot. It kind of recounts his story of going from drunkenness and slovenliness and everything to how love lit his way and duty to God and country. It's a little hokey, his conversion to Christianity, but this is one of those kind of true blue patriotic films. Not quite in the line of Yankee Doodle Dandy, but definitely easily conceived as, I hate to use this word, but unfortunately it's the most apt word, kind of the propaganda films that we put out. The upshot, of course, being that this was based on a true story, and he was a good man who did some cool stuff. The coolest thing that he did was single-handedly bringing in 132 German prisoners while they had machine guns and he had a single-shot repeater. Oh, I'm sorry, not even a repeater, it was a bolt action in World War I. And recounting his story in this journey from just nothing to American hero is really just kind of neat. And, of course, it's also one of the earlier performances of Gary Cooper, a legend in Hollywood who passed away, even though, I mean, he was 60, but far too young for me. I think he could have been, gosh, he'd probably still be amazing if he was alive today. But that would be kind of creepy because he was born in 1901. So, those are my movies. 1942's Yankee Doodle Dandy, 1980's The Elephant Man, and 1941's Sergeant York. My biopics, all black and white, all for 3 squared.
Alrighty, so I did something a little bit different with my 3 squared. God, there's just so many biopics, and so many that I forgot how many of them actually have been made. So, to help me out a bit, I just stuck with the 2000s. They're all kind of spaced apart 4 or 5 years or so. So I'll start off with the movie that came out more recently, and that is The King's Speech from 2010, directed by Tom Hooper. This is the story of King George VI, and that was played by Colin Firth. And the movie is about his dealings and copings with his stammer, as well as his relationship with a speech therapist, played wonderfully by Jeffrey Rush. This should sound familiar to a lot of people, since just a couple years ago, it won not only the Academy Award for Best Actor, but as well as the Academy Award for Best Picture. Great movie. Love how it's shot. It has some great humor in it. Great drama. Good emotion. It's just a really good story. If you're ever feeling down and out, or feel bad for yourself, or if you're just having a bad day, this is one of those movies that, you know, you should probably sit down and watch. It's not a heavily depressing movie. It's a feel-good movie. And I think this is one of the reasons why I like it so much. It's just the feel-good movie of that one can make. Personally, that's what I think. So again, that's 2010's The King's Speech, directed by Tom Hooper, about King George VI. My second film is a movie that a lot of people haven't seen. It won the Academy Award for Best Director, and I think Best Screenplay as well, back in 2007-2008, but the movie did come out in 2007, and that is Julian Schnabel's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. What a great movie. Depressing as hell, but an amazing character study. This is the film that's based on Jean-Dominique Ruby's memoir, and it was about his life after his suffering a stroke, where he was paralyzed from the neck down. And it was during that time when he was paralyzed, when he was able to only communicate through his left eye, just by blinking. Blinking yes, blinking no. He would have a nurse sit next to him and read through the alphabet, and he would blink when she got to a specific letter that he wanted her to write down. And that is how he wrote his memoirs, while he was paralyzed. Talk about a painstakingly meticulous way of creating a memoir, especially about your own life, when I'm sure this guy had so much to say before his eventual death, sometime right before he completed the book. Or excuse me, sometime right after he completed the book. It's a great movie, probably one of the most powerful movies I have seen. Again, it's a fantastic character story about Jean-Dominique Ruby. It's loving, it's touching, powerful. Again, that's Diving Bell and the Butterfly from 2007. Now finally, this movie right here came out in 2002, and I have to say, this is not only probably my favorite biopic of the 2000s, but one of my top favorite comedies of all time. This is Michael Winterbottom's 24-Hour Party People, and it's about Tony Wilson, played lovingly by Steve Coogan, and the rise of the music industry, actually the music community, in Manchester, England, between 1976 and 1992. And it also chronicles as well the rise and fall of Tony Wilson's established Factory Records. And it was Tony Wilson himself that discovered Joy Division, New Order, as well as the Happy Mondays, amongst numerous other bands that had a huge impact on the music industry and the development of punk rock throughout the late 70s and early 80s. Not only is this movie funny, but it's very touching as well. The best movie that chronicles the rise and fall of a company, or the rise and fall of an industry, it shows the evolution of punk rock into what became the club dancing ska rave club atmosphere. And it showed how the music community and how fans and how people that went out and danced to music, people that would just jump around and bang their heads to punk rock music, all that kind of switched in the late 80s, early 90s, when it became more of a club, less aesthetically pleasing atmosphere where you have a DJ. The DJ ruled the dancers. The DJ ruled the room. But however, Tony Wilson was the one that embraced that movement in music. And therefore, everything he created and everything he started, especially Factory Records, kind of fell flat. Shot himself in the foot for embracing everything that was culturally impactful in the music community throughout the years. My three were 2010's The King's Speech, 2007's The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and then finally 2002's 24-Hour Party People.
All right, so I guess we are just left with
the movies!
Yes, the movies, all right. Okay, so for our horror Hollywood October Halloween thing, we did the Poltergeist trilogy. But because it just came out this weekend, we also wanted to do Gravity. And which one would you like to do first, sir? You want to do the Poltergeist trilogy or you want to do Gravity?
Gravity.
Okay, Gravity. Oh, where to begin? Well, I guess if anyone saw my post on Facebook or Twitter, then they would have seen me saying that I just watched Gravity, and on a scale of 5 stars, I give it 6. Easily the best movie I have seen all year, thus far. It could lose its number one spot, but I doubt it. This is, of course, what we were talking about earlier. In the news, it's the 2013 3D science fiction thriller space drama film. Stars Sandra Bullock and George Clooney, primarily Sandra Bullock, who are astronauts on a spacewalk when space debris pretty much just wrecks their fucking day. Wow. This movie, okay. This movie doesn't do anything wrong. It just doesn't. Okay. It understands the very concept that there is no sound in space. So there are virtually no sound effects. Any cues you need in sound are done through the score and the soundtrack. Dialogue is done as calm dialogue. The interesting thing, of course, was Ed Harris as the mission control voice. I thought that was kind of a nice little touch. It's literally like, it's kind of like Castaway, Tom Hanks' Castaway in space, just done on a much more beautiful and large scale. You can't get much larger than space, I guess. The cinematography is utterly fantastic. Watching the background of space where the sun is rising and setting, different parts of the planet, seeing it in its day and night cycles, watching someone having to deal with true loneliness and work through their own issues in such a believable way. It was just utterly phenomenal. And I literally was like halfway gripping the stupid armrest almost the whole movie. And it didn't let up, but you didn't feel like it was, oh, come on, what else could go wrong? Oh, come on, let's get on with it. It was perfectly paced, perfectly acted, excellently written, amazingly directed, awesome story. I will go see this movie with anybody who wants to go. Give me a shout. I'm there. Let's do this. This movie is just absolutely fantastic. hands down, again, I will say it again, the best movie thus far I have seen this year. 6 out of 5 stars. That good.
All right, so Gravity. Right off the bat, out of 5 stars, I give this movie 4 stars. And I have plenty of information to back this up. First off, I just want to say that this is a movie that is important. It is important to see on a large screen and in 3D. This movie is technically phenomenal and absolutely flawless, with a great utilization of music and sound, or lack thereof sound, and sound effects. However, much of the suspense, the drive, and the feeling of the audience member of wanting the actors to make it depends on the connection that is established by the film's tone, the story, and most importantly, it depends on the emotional connection with the character. Now, I bought the tone, I completely bought the story, and I felt the tension, for the most part. But what I didn't buy was the emotional connection that the movie was trying to establish between the audience and Sandra Bullock's character of Ryan Stone. To me, it came across as forced emotion, which relied a lot on the believability of Ryan Stone's backstory. But what did I want? Now, I wanted something that was natural, not bits of pieces of what I kind of felt were clunky dialogue that pop up too obviously from time to time just to prepare the viewer for the part of the movie when the said dialogue will actually come into play. Some of the movies of reference where I felt utilizes the same kind of way of using dialogue and using a backstory for emotional impact, but however, they don't rely only on the character's backstory to make a kind of emotional tie. And to me, these movies, one of them which was actually directed by Alfonso Cuarón, they did it in the most natural, characteristically, what I think, pleasing way. And one is Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men, and then you have Danny Boyle's 127 Hours. You have the backstory there, but it's not just kind of thrown into your face just so it will come into play later on in the movie. And so that's what I just didn't like. Now, and lastly, to me, a great film, or a perfect film, is one that can be viewed on both the big screen as well as the small screen without it losing any of its rewatchability or majestic sparkle. In the case of Gravity, it may not lose its rewatchability. However, I think if I were to put it in a little, watch it on like a 14-inch TV, I think it will definitely lose its majestic sparkle. Yeah, so therefore I give it 4 stars. Again, I think technically the movie's astounding. The camera work, the use of single long shots, like shots that were maybe like 5 or 6 minutes, 6, 7 minutes long, which Alfonso Cuarón is really good at. I mean, look at Children of Men. There are 3 shots following Clive Owen around during a war, pretty much, or in a car with it getting ambushed. So he's really good at doing shots like that. And he utilizes that art of camera movement and following a story in one shot quite well in the movie. So I think it's a really good movie. I just personally don't think it would hold up as much on a small screen. And to me, it seems like this movie, what it has going for it, is it has amazing special effects, amazing 3D, and it looks absolutely beautiful on the big screen. I just can't consider it as a spectacular, great movie.
I think that's where the advent of home movie theaters have really kind of, for the most part, negated your argument. I was at Sam's today. I had to go and get I was running errands this morning before we recorded the show. I saw a 50-inch LED TV, 1080p, didn't have Wi-Fi on it. 50-inch, $498. It's not that expensive anymore to get that kind of size and that kind of quality and have it in your room and then recreate and with relative certainty recreate a theater experience. Is it the 50-foot screen? It is not. But with today's technology, it is not that difficult to replicate 3D and movie making. And I also saw it in 3D in the whole nine yards. But and me, I you know, just my lowly 46-inch LED is going to be good enough for me. I don't anticipate that's going to be a problem. Should you be watching it on your computer or your laptop? No, of course not. And if you make that your first viewing, then certainly I could see where you would be coming from because you don't have that sense of scope. But I don't think that... But again, it's clearly... I'm not trying to make you change your mind or anything, but it does seem to me that... It feels to me that that's kind of a cop-out for pulling a whole star off of a movie that you say is that good. Just because if someone doesn't get the chance to see it in the theater, they're not going to like it as much?
No, not at all. It's not a cop-out whatsoever. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad movie, and I'm not saying that it was a bad theater-going experience. I want everybody, if anybody loves movies or enjoys, or just anybody, should definitely go and experience this movie. However, I feel it's more of a experience movie than I think it's a, well, watch it at home kind of movie. I mean, you look at, say, Avatar. Now, I didn't absolutely love Avatar. I enjoyed Avatar, but a number of sequences in that movie were geared towards 3D. And, wow, look at these special effects on the big screen that if you watch it on a smaller screen, you know, doesn't really transition well. You look at a great movie like, say, Godfather or Citizen Kane, The King's Speech, for example, or Yankee Doodle Dandy. Any movie that is considered, or a classic, It's a Wonderful Life, even, Gone with the Wind. You can sit down and watch those movies on any size screen and still get the same emotional connection. I can get the same enjoyment as if I watched it on a huge screen. I can still relate to the characters when I needed to relate to them and all that jazz. And to me, even while watching on the big screen, the connection between me, one of the audience members, and the character of Ryan Stone, I didn't connect to her. So, taking off one star, that one star represented the movie is an event-ish type movie. To me, it wouldn't translate well to a smaller screen, which is what, to me, what makes a five-star movie. And also, the movie was relying on a connection between the audience and the character who is going through all this peril and wanting her to make it, wanting her to survive, and wanting her to get through it. Because she's just this fighting character, and she's just this fighting woman who is just, she's just in this very harrowing, horrible predicament. Then all she wants to do is just get back home. I just thought it was forced, and I just didn't connect.
It seems like you're kind of comparing it. It seems to me that you're still kind of comparing it to apples and oranges a little bit. Because The Godfather and Gone with the Wind are hardly comparable to each other, much less to this movie. So let me.
But those are considered great movies, is what I'm saying. To me, those are five-star movies.
Okay, well let's put the same movie against the same style of movie. The actual Tom Hanks Castaway.
But Castaway is
similar in tone. I would say that movie is exceptionally similar in tone to Gravity. Which do you think that movie is better, worse, or about the same as Gravity?
To me, I think Castaway is the better movie. Castaway made me weep over a man losing his best friend, which is a ball. That movie succeeded. So to me, Castaway is the better movie. It's a survival movie, but I felt more connected with Tom Hanks' character.
Now that we're done with that, let's get into...
This week's Airheads.
Alright, so our horror movies this week, we decided to do the Poltergeist Trilogy. Yes, Poltergeist, the not as bad, still pretty good Poltergeist 2, and the holy fuck, what the hell were they thinking, Poltergeist 3. I'm just gonna, you know what, for me, there's not really a whole lot to separate between the first two movies. The first movie was definitely the best. It was clear that this one set up a lot of tropes for the horror movie genre going forward in terms of solid catchphrases, an interesting way to explain the phenomenon that was going on, creepy characters, and not just horror characters, but, you know, actual, like, Tangina Barons, the medium, and everything. good special effects. You know what? Not to take that back. Great special effects for the time. And just kind of one of those things where it was just a really interesting story. This is a really, really good movie for its time. I don't want to say that it didn't age well, because it aged okay. There's a lot of really cool stuff that you can still take from this today if this is your first time viewing this movie. But at the same time, it does feel dated. I would give this movie a 3.5 stars out of 5 because it is. I still like this movie. I still think that there is a lot that people can pull from this movie in terms of enjoyment and good scares, especially if you're someone who doesn't really like horror movies to begin with. This will probably be a nice intro for you because it's a little bit cheesy in some regards. So that'll kind of set you up. And then when it starts getting like really intense towards the end, it'll be scary enough for you that you'll still get into it, but not, oh dear God, I'm going to have nightmares forever scary. Jumping into the second one, though, what I like that they did about the second one, it's a little bit weaker because they chose to continue the story directly, which was kind of cool. Think Insidious 2, where they're continuing the story directly after the first, but where the movie starts to kind of slip a little bit. And again, they brought back the original cast, which I thought was pretty cool in terms of Heather O'Rourke, Craig T. Nelson, Jo Beth Williams, and Tangina Behrens. I'm sorry, Zelda Rubinstein. They were trying a little too hard to still keep that authentic feel. But what I thought was really inventive was the introduction of the character of Kane, Reverend Harry Kane, who is the epitomized monster, the demon monster referred to as kind of the group head of the Poltergeist spirit world in the first Poltergeist. So I liked where they were trying to actually create something with the franchise to carry it on and create a solid sequel out of it. What I didn't like was that where they did so well with that, they didn't have anything really left to do with the Freeling family, so it's kind of just like, why are you just after this? This girl can't be that special. And so it kind of suffered. And you can tell, because you can even see by the box office receipts that the first movie budget was a little over $10 million, made $120 million. Second movie budget, almost $20 million, $40 million. And they should have just stopped there, because they did kind of close it off in the second one, and they could have left it alone, but no. They come up with the third one, and they only bring back Heather O'Rourke and Zelda Rubinstein. You get very early appearance of Laura Flynn Boyle, for those of you who are fans there, and then, of course, Tom Skerritt in a really-was-your-career-this-bad-already role. Maybe you lost a bet. I don't know. But then they come back, and you have Poltergeist 3, where Kane has now decided that no matter what, he's going to get poor little Carol Ann, and clearly, this was just trying to get a grab on the thing. It is terribly acted. The plot is just stupid. But the coolest thing in this whole movie is a crack in the mirrors of the building in the hallway by the elevators that just goes all the way up the building. The one interesting thing was in this particular movie, Kane controls the shadows, the mirror images of people and stuff. And so the mirror image is doing the opposite thing of the people and was kind of interesting. But then it just kind of, it never goes anywhere. It's stupid scares. It's just poorly written, really poorly acted. You can see these people's careers are just going nowhere quickly. It's almost as if they have nothing left. You're almost kind of glad some people die as a result of the curse of this movie. At least that's what they say. The movie has a just retarded ending where they try and rescue Kane, of all things. And then they leave you with the stupid cliffhanger that is pointless to have, and nothing's ever come of it ever since. It's just one of the worst in the movies. Oh, dear God. The second movie, I gave the first movie 3.5 stars. The second movie is 2.5 stars, and I'm being generous there. The third movie is, it's just 1 star. It's just, I hate that movie. It's just terrible, 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 terrible movie. Should not have been made. There you go. That is the Poltergeist trilogy. Carol Ann survives all 3 attempts, and that's pretty much it.
And as what Tangina would say,
the Poltergeist trilogy. Let's review.
I have exorcised the demons.
Yeah, it's just, she gets all like gargly and
She talks like this, but then when it gets very serious, I talk like this.
A little bit of too much Twin Peaks, I think, by the end of it.
She Twin Peaked. Okay, so I'm not going to really go through the first Poltergeist movie as much. It's a classic, great special effects, produced by Spielberg. I remember watching it as a kid and being freaked out by the end. And the movie really goes all out horror, all out terrifying, and pretty damn sinister as well. It's one of those movies that, to me, it's difficult not to give it a really good rating. Because I can watch it now and be a little blasé about thinking about its pitfalls, but it's just, to me, it's a really good movie, and it totally, I think it still holds up, even now, just watching it as a good classic horror movie. Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, this was definitely an Academy Award-winning movie for 1986. Definitely better than any of the movies it was going up against. I think, yeah, between this and Poltergeist 3 and Driving Miss Daisy, which was nominated, better than Driving Miss Daisy. Totally better.
Not.
I will say that Poltergeist 2 was nominated for a Razzie Award as well as an Academy Award for Best Visual Effects. Tangina, Zella Rubinstein, was nominated for a Razzie Award. She was going, as what Mike was saying, as Mike, as Matt was saying, totally Twin Peaked with the raspy voiceness of
Tangina.
Okay, so now onto the review of Poltergeist 2, The Other Side from 1986. Yeah, I'll say it right now, Matt enjoyed this movie more so than I. I just think that the sequel relies heavily, heavily on the happenings of the first movie. So much. They keep referencing it. It's just everything. It's like, well, is this happening again? And you know, or every time the family will do something fun and entertaining, or once they like kind of look off the camera and start thinking and start thinking about the past, a flashback from Poltergeist will come up and they'll show some of the horrifying happenings that happened during the final scenes of the movie, that all the peril the family went through, and just to kind of conjure up the same terrifying feelings that the audience felt during Poltergeist. But so the family went through all that peril, and I believe the second one takes place a year later. And yet, when something creepy happens, and once they kind of have, or once the mom starts seeing weird visuals, or starts noticing that something is different with Carol Ann, they do absolutely nothing. And Craig T. Nelson rattles off one-liners and kind of writes everything off like, oh, everything is fine. Despite a year ago, we lost our entire house due to a shift in a paranormal event. Everything's fine. I mean, there's no way in hell. That's got to be a one-off thing. That's not going to happen again. But yet, something big happens about 20-some-odd minutes into Poltergeist 2. And where do they end up? They end up in a diner. After getting terrorized, they go to a diner, and therefore they start rationalizing and trying to rationalize the situation and trying to, again, write it off as if, you know, surely it can't happen again. It can't be the same thing. Maybe we can just put up with it. Maybe it could be friendly ghosts. Who knows? It could not be the same paranormal, otherworldly happenings that we were once put through. During that scene, the mom encounters her mom in the form of somebody else's body. And despite all the paranormal activity that happened before, the dad writes it off as, that sometimes happens. The mom witnesses her own mother as the voice of another diner patron. And the dad says, well, that stuff sometimes happens. That's not a direct quote, but that is virtually what he says. Shit happens, basically. Just doesn't make sense. Again, Craig T. Nelson's one-liners. It's hard to take anything seriously. It's hard to really get full balls deep into the paranormal scares, into what's happening with the family or happening to the family. Just the jokes. Jokes just kind of screw over the movie. There's no point of taking things seriously if the main character doesn't take it seriously, or if the father doesn't take it seriously. Again, despite all the peril they were put through a year before. And all that stuff happens during the first half of the movie. And it's not until kind of the middle mark, like 40, 50 minutes into the movie, where the creepiness starts to happen. And one of the most successful creepy scenes in the movie is really the introduction of Old Man Kane It's when he's walking past their house and he sees Carol Ann and the playing in the yard, and then he has a confrontation with Craig T. Nelson, the dad, on the front porch, and they have the screen door in between them, and the camera just zooms into Kane's face, and his face is very skeletal. It's old, it's wrinkly. You see his face bones, his jaw bones just protruding, and just this wide-eyed, shit-eating grin. And he just has that face you just want to punch repeatedly and just beat in. It's just, God, it's just creepy. And nothing else in the movie will build upon that moment. And nothing can compare to that moment. And that's where the second half of the movie ultimately fails. And of course, they have Taylor, the Native American in the movie, who is the wise Native American with all the answers and provides necessary explanation to move the story along. And with any horror movie, or any movie in particular that has these particular characters that are just there for a specific scene, just to, oh, well, the paranormal activity, this is all begin if this is this is this happens. And by the end of the movie, he knows the way of defeating Kane and putting a stop to all the evil if the family just does this. But yet, he doesn't make any of that stuff known earlier on in the movie. It has just a lot of stuff like that. And especially the ending of the movie. They end the movie with a forced upbeat joke, despite all the corniness that just happened at the film, especially at the film's ending. So, first half of the movie, a lot of crappy one-liners, a lot of stuff that doesn't make sense, and then you have a really shitty ending. My final verdict of Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, is that it feels like a movie based on one line, the tagline, which is, "They're back." The whole ending is not only poorly thought out and cheesy beyond belief, but it seems as if a stoned eighth grader conceived it and wrote it and directed it. Poltergeist 2, The Other Side, 1 star for me. Next up is Poltergeist 3, which, believe it or not, is even worse. I mean, this movie is on the verge of being laughably bad. If you have drinking at least 4 or 5 beers, or had some tequila shots, you will laugh your ass off through this entire movie. Only I wish I did take part in drinking 4 to 5 beers or drinking copious amounts of tequila before watching it. Where to begin with this movie? First off, horrible acting, horrible screenplay, horrible chemistry between actors, the relationships between the characters, as well as the jokes fall completely flat. To me, this was a D-grade flick with a decent budget. There was a horrible use of a villain. Kane, again, comes back for the third movie. God, yeah, just one of the worst uses of a great villain that I've ever seen. And Kane was definitely the creepiest thing, again, about Poltergeist 2. However, the actor died before the second Poltergeist finished filming. Yet, the filmmakers, or the screenwriter, had to incorporate him as the main villain for this movie. It's obviously noticeable that it's a different actor portraying Kane when he just randomly pops up from time to time in random scenes. I mean, they use the same, I think, face sculpt sculpture that they used for special effects and makeup effects for this Poltergeist 2, that they just threw on some other guy for Poltergeist 3. It's never a close-up shot of Kane. It's always far-away shots. And he doesn't really ever say any complete sentences, because it's always muddled out by music or special effects or just kind of yelling, to where I think a lot of people can impersonate people when they're yelling. And it just doesn't work. It's like you have a great villain that could have been super creepy and terrifying beyond belief, yet you just make it obvious that it's not the same guy. It just annoyed me throughout the entire movie. There are absolutely no redeeming qualities about this movie, other than maybe a couple cool shots they have, one pertaining to kind of like what Matt was talking about earlier with the mirrors, the husband and wife and Tangina and the other the psychiatrist guy looking through the mirrors. And they had that whole scene where the psychiatrist is slowly figuring out, like, holy shit, you know, maybe all this paranormal activity and all this otherworldliness stuff is actually happening. That was kind of cool. And then there was another shot in another little 10-second segment that comes maybe a minute after that one shot is established, and that is when the husband and wife, their daughter, starts crawling out of a dead body. And to me, that was pretty horrifying looking, and it was just great makeup and terrific setup and very creepy and completely out of nowhere, and it worked. I just wish there was more of that type of thing in this movie. Again, another stupid ending.
they defeat Kane with kindness.
Come on, Kane. Let me show you the light.
Yeah, or whatever Tangina says. Showing him the light. But however, Tangina did it because she wanted to sacrifice her life. Forced emotion, a forced ending, and it was all very stupid. Final verdict? This movie is laughably bad. Like I said, a disgrace to the original Poltergeist film. Neither sequel can compare to the original's originality and true ability to produce quality scares in a genuinely, terrifyingly entertaining movie-going experience. Poltergeist 3, I rate it 0 to maybe half a star. Poltergeist 2, 1 star. And there you go.
Awesome. All right. Well, got that out of the way. So, next week, we will be bringing back our masterpiece discussion, where we are going to discuss the current state of horror movies. And we will tell you what the next 3 squared will be then. For next week, we're going to be watching VHS 1 and 2, and the horror anthologies Trick or Treat, Black Sabbath, and Tales from the Hood, which is the gangster remake of Tales from the Crypt. So, hey, these are horror anthologies, you see. That's our wonderful little theme for next week. I believe that just leaves us with the spiel. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct. Spiel on.
All right. Well, then, the music that you've been listening to, well, the regular music you listen to, as always, is provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can catch them at criesofsolace.com. You can also go to reverbnation.com, myspace.com, and facebook.com/criesofsolace.
And the additional horror music was provided by Kevin MacLeod, and the title of that song is Rising Game. And we got that on Incompetech. .com. That is incompetech.com, and it's licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And you can find that website at creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0/. And again, the additional horror music was provided by Kevin MacLeod. And the title of the song was Rising Game.
For us, well, we're still the SLS Cast, and you can go to slscast.com. You can also send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast. You can go to facebook.com, search the SLS Cast, and of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. And until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Jason Patrick, I get to say, it's easy to be a movie star. The shoes are already there. They just put you in the shoes.
Huh. This is Tim saying, cheers.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.